Another extension of unemployment benefits looks unlikely.
So what does that mean for the economy?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in New York, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, November 30th. Coming up, how much should the internet cost if you use a lot of it? A museum that has a visible pot of gold. And the Kardashians were gold to cable television. Just how are they doing with debit cards these days? All that coming up.
But first, today funding runs out for extended unemployment benefits. That's about $310 a week on average for up to 99 weeks. It's paid for by the federal government to people who are out of work. Well, Democrats have been trying to pass a $12 billion extension package since before Thanksgiving. But yesterday, Republicans again successfully blocked that package, saying the money will add to the deficit. So if 2 million long-term unemployed Americans lose their assistance, which businesses will feel it? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went to find out.
The average unemployment check's $300 a week, the bottom of the income ladder where families typically spend well over half of what they make on necessities. So when unemployment checks stop, it's felt right away by businesses like gas stations, apartment operators, and grocery stores.
A good portion of our business currently is subsidized by public assistance.
Grant McLaughlin is with Fresh Grocer, with 10 stores in Philadelphia.
People that don't have the unemployment insurance may not shop there at all or be shopping elsewhere, or I don't know what they're going to do, but it certainly impact our bottom line, which would probably force us to cut back on our labor force.
I asked Kathy Getzla of Blaine, Washington, what she'll do. She's 60, has been out of work for 18 months, and says she's already cut her food, gas, and utility bills to the bone.
I just hope to, you know, squeak by, but it'll be on savings I had not anticipated to be dipping into.
If funding isn't restored, it could slow the economy next year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now let's get some reaction with Julie Neiman. She's with us from Smith, Moore & Company in St. Louis, where she is an analyst. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So if nothing passes today, a couple of million people will lose their benefits. What does that mean for our economy?
Well, basically, you're going to see a decline in what very modest consumer buying there is now. A decline in consumption typically leads a decline in employment at worst, and at best, no new hiring. And 70% of our economy depends upon consumption, so this is just another wet blanket over everything.
So a decline in consumption. Now, Julie, I'm sure you've heard this argument that some have made that by continuing to extend these unemployment benefits, that you reduce the incentive for people who have been out of work to go and find new work. What's your take on that?
Well, the big argument, is it now welfare or is it unemployment benefits? Unemployment benefits are really the best stimulus that a government has available. It's very direct, it's very effective, and it's a good economic stabilizer. But trying to find a job is a key thing. You know, most people now are trying to find any job they can find. Some people want jobs at their former levels, suitable work in line with training and experience that they had before. The problem is we've got age discrimination going on out there, and there's an out-of-work bias as well. If you're out of work, it's much tougher to become employed rather than somebody who just moves from jobs. So there are many things stacked against people trying to find jobs right now, and they're going to be reduced to trying to take anything they can find, but even those jobs are being taken very quickly as well. And we're talking about very low-level retail jobs, pet walking, you know, dog sitting, virtually anything that can keep a little bit of bread on the table. So we're looking at the significantly lower levels of consumption for 2 million people immediately, and this could continue on.
All right. Well, a lot at stake in this debate in Congress today. Thanks, Julie.
You bet.
A battle royale's broken out between Comcast and Level 3 Communications. Comcast, of course, provides cable and internet service to millions of customers across the country. Level 3 is the streaming video partner for Netflix, the mail and web movie renting people. Now, Level 3 says Comcast is unfairly charging additional fees for streaming bigger pieces of video, like movies. Comcast says all those movies are a big drain on its bandwidth, and it has to charge more to provide that added bandwidth. Cecilia Kong is technology writer for The Washington Post. She's with us from D.C. Good morning.
Hi.
So what's this fight really about? Give us an analogy here, if you can.
Sure. Well, the fight is really about the battle over TV and how people are going to watch TV going forward. Comcast is seeing people cut the cord. They're seeing people actually drop their subscriptions, and you have this juggernaut of the internet called Netflix. It's no longer really a mail order DVD service. It's become the streaming threat to cable companies. And Netflix is partnered with Level 3. And Level 3 says that now Comcast, a competitor of Netflix, is demanding more money to transmit the traffic of videos to Comcast users.
I sense a juggernaut, Cecilia, in the cable bill that comes. How's this going to affect consumers?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and particularly as Comcast tries to merge with NBC Universal, and there's lots of questions about how Comcast will be more powerful after this and how some of these higher fees that they may demand from competitors can trickle down to consumers. It's, you know, Comcast is in an interesting position in that everything is being disrupted by the internet, and if more people are getting their television entertainment, if they're watching The Office and watching Glee over Hulu and the internet, and they're doing less so over cable channels, then what does Comcast do to keep its huge cash cow going? And a lot of those questions boil down to how it can control its pipes, how it can control traffic over the internet. And that's why this particular complaint by Level 3, these allegations are interesting, is because the federal government, the Federal Communications Commission, is looking more closely at how cable companies like Comcast, how internet companies like AT&T and Verizon will deal with this massive transition to the internet.
I see all these tiered pricing plans, Cecilia,
yeah,
for wireless carriers, right? AT&T and Verizon, they're talking about, you know, you use this much bandwidth and that much bandwidth. Is that coming to cable companies too?
Well, if you think that your cell phone bill is complicated now, it's going to only get more complicated, and the same will be the case for cable bills. There's a bevy of ways for cable companies and for cell phone companies and any communications company to start charging you in the future when it comes to internet data, because you can slice and dice things in many different ways. You can say, I'll charge you a couple dollars more to serve up, say, Facebook faster on your home through cable networks or through your cell phone. You can charge more for bundling certain channels over your cell phone or cable. It's just a cornucopia of different options.
A lot of changes coming, I'm sure.
Right, a lot of things coming, and it could mean a lot of confusion to your bill, a lot more complicated, many more pages perhaps.
Cecilia Kong from The Washington Post. Cecilia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Steve, here on the East Coast, this has been big news. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie put the kibosh on another Hudson River transit tunnel that would connect New Jersey to New York. Christie was afraid cost overruns would bankrupt the Garden State.
Yeah, but Jeremy, Uncle Sam was pitching in some of the money too. And now the federal government has sent a bill to the state of New Jersey requesting repayment of cash that the federal government, had already spent on the project before it was ditched. You know how much?
How much?
$271 million payable upon receipt and with reasonable interest. You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 30th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers section at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
European investigators today opened an inquiry into whether Google illegally pushes competitors out of its search results. It is the first major investigation into the online company's business practices. The BBC's technology reporter, Jonathan Fildes, is with us now from London with the latest. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi there.
Google's gargantuan search engine, what do rivals say that they've done to abuse their size?
Well, the rivals are saying that Google is tweaking its algorithms, so these algorithms that it uses to produce its search results, and it's tweaking those so it promotes its own services and penalizes its competitors. So in particular, it's penalizing sites like price comparison sites and these so-called vertical search engines, which focus in a very specific area.
Now, John, this is a cutthroat business, right? I mean, some would claim that anyway. Is there something wrong with this?
Well, I think Google's size is a worry, and the fact that it's now using that size potentially and allegedly to push out competitors. And the competitors say that this is kind of stifling innovation and not giving consumers choice.
What kind of broader implications are we talking about? Could this spread to, say, the United States?
Well, we've already seen a very broad investigation launched in the US. So earlier this year, the Attorney General of Texas launched a very similar investigation. In fact, it launched that investigation due to complaints brought by some of the same firms, including this British firm called Foundum.
The BBC's technology reporter, Jonathan Fildes in London. Jonathan, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a tough year for people who've suffered at the hands of catastrophes. There was the horrific earthquake in Haiti, devastating floods in Pakistan, and the oil spill right here in our own backyard in the Gulf of Mexico. Added to all the other disasters on the planet, a new study says the price tag this year is triple what it was last year. From London, Christopher Worth explains.
Google's rivals, including Microsoft, say Google favors its own search results and pushes its rivals way down the list. They say the company is abusing its dominant share of the search market and stops some websites from running competing ads. The EU says it will investigate those claims, but Danny Sullivan at SearchEngineLand.com says the allegations show a misunderstanding of how search engines work. He says Google's job is to create its own search results and to point people to destination websites.
It would be as if you said, I'm very upset at the New York Times because they write all these articles from their own reporters favoring people to stay at the New York Times. What they really ought to do is have a headline of all these articles that says, to learn about this story, go read it in the Wall Street Journal.
And such scrutiny could follow Google. Much like Microsoft faced antitrust abroad and at home, Sullivan says there have already been similar allegations against Google in the U.S. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
With the European bailout and a whole lot of budget cuts in the works, you might think it's not the best time to open a new public attraction in Ireland. But some brave souls who believe magic can still happen, even in a tough economy, have done just that by opening a leprechaun museum. Reporter Anne-Marie McNerney visited the museum in Dublin and filed this report.
Leprechaun is a magical being. They are small-sized people. You know one when you see one.
Tom O'Rahilly is the founder and director of the world's first leprechaun museum. It opened its doors last March, just on time for St. Patrick's Day.
We've had 40,000 people through the doors now. We're attracting 75% foreign visitors, 25% domestic.
It couldn't be a tougher time to start a new business in Ireland.
That's true, and there's a lot of range difficulties presented, but there's opportunities there as well. This business wasn't viable 3 years ago. This building was scheduled for demolition. It didn't get demolished because of the market declined. We were able to rent it at a reasonable rate then.
This is Ireland. Island of myths and legends. Our stories rooted in reality and steeped in fantasy.
The Leprechaun Museum invites people into a leprechaun-sized world and allows them to journey to the end of the rainbow to see if that crock of gold exists. Tahi O'Hogan, a professor at the Department of Folklore in University College Dublin, says the museum opens up the realm of folklore and fairy people to the public.
This museum consists of storytelling, maps and various reconstructions of fairy dwellings and so on. The leprechaun is, if you like, the little doorman who invites you in to this view of the other world.
At first, when you go through, it's really dark and really scary.
We loved it. It was beautiful. The interior is amazing. And then the story of the stories is brilliantly told.
Believe it or not, leprechauns are not just a Hollywood invention. The first documentary evidence goes back to the 8th century. So to the really important question, do leprechauns still exist? Tom O'Rahilly of the Leprechaun Museum in Dublin.
If they've been around for 1,300 years and the cynics haven't managed to get rid of them now, well, they're obviously quite persistent and there's a reason for them being here. They're part of the culture.
In Dublin, I'm Anne-Marie McNerney for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, letting the market decide has again produced something there is apparently some demand for. Mm. It is a new non-alcoholic beer made just for dogs. It's called dog beer, of course.
Of course.
And it's beef flavored, of course, no. Because that's apparently what dogs like. The Australian-based brewer recommends one bottle per day for large dogs and just a shot or two for a little dog like a chihuahua. As for poodles, Steve, I think they prefer dog wine.
Naturally.
Because they're a very classy breed. listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 30th. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
Well, this morning we have an updated price tag for the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP, that expired back in October. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the total cost to the taxpayer will be just $25 billion. Not peanuts, but far less than the original price tag and less than government analysts predicted just 6 months ago. Marketplace's Gregory Warner is covering this story for us today, and he joins us from Philadelphia. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's changed here?
Well, you remember General Motors went public earlier this month and it shed majority ownership. AIG sold off billions of dollars of assets. Plus, you know, homeowners did not sign up to take advantage of federal programs to avoid foreclosure. So a lot of that $700 billion authorized by Congress never got used.
And of course, there was the money that went to the banks, which was a large part of that as well. So we hear now that the bailout's going to cost taxpayers some $25 billion, according to this estimate. It was a very unpopular program. Do you think this low price tag is going to answer some of the critics?
I mean, not really, because yes, many economists would argue that had we not had that infusion of cash to stabilize the banks, our economy would be far worse. But the bailout was just one of a bunch of government programs propping up Wall Street, and a lot of the real cost was shifted to those other programs that have gotten less public attention. For example, you know, the bailout of Fannie Freddie. The government purchased hundreds of billions of dollars of bad home loans, which continue to prop up the housing market and keep banks from having a wave of defaults on their books. That's allowed those banks to pay back the bailout money, and it's one reason the price tag this morning looks as pretty as it does.
All right, Marketplace's Gregory Warner will be watching to see if that price tag comes down any further, but thanks so much for your help this morning.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The United Nations Climate Summit is underway in Cancun, Mexico, and the expectations for what will come out of it couldn't be lower. That has some people looking in other directions for answers to climate change.
But some small businesses are moving ahead and finding that going green actually helps their bottom line. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Badger Mountain Vineyard in Washington State has all sorts of EnviroCred. The winemakers grow organic grapes. They get cooking oil from local restaurants to make biodiesel for their tractors. They have solar panels on their tasting room. They're finished pressing their grapes for the season. The leftover bits will be composted, and the juice has stained their equipment the pinky purple color favored by preteen girls. But they aren't just making choices that are good for the environment. Most of them are also good for their bottom line. Take their decision to box their organic wine.
With the box wines, it was a way to maybe tap into a new market. And afterwards, you're thinking, well, this works pretty well for the environment as well.
Greg Power says the boxed wine market has been good, really good.
We sold our annual projection in the first quarter.
So Franzia was on to something. Power says boxes are good for wine. It stays fresher longer. The wine isn't exposed to air when it's opened. And boxed wine is good for the environment because there's less waste, less heavy glass to transport. Sustainability for a small business means taking environmental steps, but also means taking steps to ensure your business lives long and prospers. Something Greg's dad, Bill Powers, knew when he decided to try to grow grapes organically.
When we first started, boy, I'll tell you, everybody acted like I was a kind of a nut, you know.
He did it because he saw other farmers getting sick and was worried about his son and the other young men working in the farm. Now he's proud, at least as proud as a modest farmer can be, that other grape growers have cut back their chemical use based on his example. He found what a lot of small business owners are discovering, that there are ways to rethink their product that's good for business and the earth. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Staying with our sustainability coverage, the U.S. Senate today is likely to pass sweeping new food safety reforms. Now, the legislation steps up federal inspections and the ability for the government to recall bad food. But bioengineers keep churning out new kinds of food for regulators to oversee, like a fruit that defies open-air hardship. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Critics call it the Botox apple. It's a genetically modified apple that doesn't turn brown soon after slicing. Bioengineers turned off the enzyme that triggers discoloration. Neil Carter heads the Canadian company seeking approval to market the apple here.
You know, the consumer will see an apple that appears better. They can cut it in the home and, the night before and put it in the kids' lunch, and it won't be brown in the kids' lunch where they go, yuck, I'm not eating that.
But retailers and consumers will ultimately determine this apple's success. Genetically modified potatoes failed here after McDonald's refused to buy them. Food activists like Andrew Kimbrell are already frowning on this apple.
We here at the Center for Food Safety are actually concerned that by not turning brown, it may not alert cooks and consumers to the fact that these apples are spoiled.
But one analyst says a little cosmetic surgery may just be what the lowly apple needs. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, the Kardashians, well, they're getting out of the debit card business.
Ah.
Not a long business for them. Connecticut's attorney general looked at whether the card pushed by the reality TV family violated consumer protection laws.
Yeah, the prepaid card set people back about 10 bucks and then carried a $7.95 a month fee. And if you wanted to add money to the card, Jeremy, it was another $1.50 each time you did that. So the Kardashians say they made this decision because they wanted to be good stewards for young adults, of course, who are the card's target audience.
Of course. And doesn't the Consumers Union know it? They say prepaid debit cards tied to celebrities are all the rage. People want to be just like their favorite celebs, rich and famous.
Unless, of course, the fees make them broke and jaded.
Well, some celebrities are broken jaded,
already,
too, so maybe
you're
they
right.
want to be like that.
They don't need a debit card to do that. Exactly. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.